here is how I want us to start off our time together with this discussion question. What thing are you most proud of completing? What thing are you most proud of completing? This could be a project, a race, a season, a school program, more, but what thing are you most proud of completing? Talk about that at your tables for a moment. Make sure you know everyone's name, and then we'll get some answers. For me, I'm going to cheat on one of my answers, and then, but my first answer would be just, for me, it was the process of ordination. And if you know anything about some of my testimony, you'll know that public speaking used to be my biggest fear. Ministry was the last thing I wanted to do. And so kind of played the role of Jonah, running away from that call. And so just like God's work in my own heart and different things to go from being terrified of public speaking through the process of ordination and internships and masters and all that, like it was just one of those, similar to the way you would have felt like graduating college, of like, oh my goodness, it's been a long journey. One of the my other answer, and this is a little bit cheating, but for some of you that are newer to 20-somethings, you may not know the backstory here. My answer would actually be 20-somethings, and I'm proud of many of the folks here. And if you know anything about the way this ministry started, there was a previous kind of college ministry attempt that God had used in many ways, but had essentially collapsed. And I was kind of pulled in, and Jay and Jane soon after say, hey, we need to lead a Bible study for some of the folks that would still come. And really in the Minix house, they still have the same rocking chair we used to sit in. It's kind of become like a little sacred place. And we started this Bible study and in some ways didn't know what to expect and thought maybe this will last a year, we don't know. And to see what God has done since, to see the investment of so many of you as I look across this room and what God has done in you and the way he's grown this space. I mean, it's been really cool. And in the most sanctified way, I'm just proud of you guys and just to see where we've come from. And yeah, it was cool even just thinking about that. Like, yeah, we're not done. We have so much more to do. But just to see what God has done leading up to this moment. This semester and last semester, we've gone through the book of Revelation. And this week, we're going to look at Revelation chapter 13 and 14. And in just a moment, we'll read those chapters together. But what I want to do is remind us of what we talked about in Revelation chapter 12 last week, because unless we remember some of what's going on there, some of this passage won't make sense, because Revelation chapter 12 through 14 are kind of a unit. But last week, we focused on just chapter 12. So just as a brief reminder of Revelation chapter 12, we saw a woman representing God's people throughout the ages, and she's about to give birth. And there's this great dragon representing Satan that is there ready to devour her child as soon as she has birth. And so the child is born. The woman has a son. This represents Jesus. And Satan, the dragon, basically kills the baby, and the baby ultimately goes up to glory with God in power, and representing the crucifixion of Christ and the resurrection, the ascension. And then we see the woman, she flees to the wilderness, and we've used this term of 1,260 days or 42 months or time and a half of time. They all mean the same thing, of this period of significant persecution and suffering that God will suddenly bring to an end. So God is protecting her in the wilderness. She's in the wilderness. Satan is doing whatever he can to destroy God's people. That's what some of this stands for. And ultimately, in the rest of the chapter, we see that the saints have victory over Satan by the blood of Christ and the word of their testimony. By the blood of Christ and the word of their testimony. Because through Jesus at the cross, when he atones for our sin, he covers us by his blood. Satan's accusations have no power over us anymore. Satan has no authority over us. When he goes to God and says, God, look at the way this person has sinned and rebelled against you, God says, I see none of that anymore. There is complete forgiveness because of the sacrifice of Jesus. So the saints triumph over Satan by the blood of Christ and the word of their testimony. And then the chapter begins to end by this view of Satan raging because he knows his time in this world is short. And so he's going to do whatever he can to destroy God's people and to wreak havoc in the world. And the very last line of the chapter ends like this. The dragon, that is Satan, stood at the sand of the sea. The dragon stood at the sand of the sea. And this is right where our passage picks up. And so we're going to go ahead and read chapters 13 and 14. So as we've done, let's stand together. If you have your Bible, I encourage you, read along as I read. Read silently along. And we're going to read chapters 13 and 14, and we'll begin to break those down and apply them. This is Revelation chapter 13 and 14. And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, and on its horns were 10 crowns, and on its heads were blasphemous names. The beast I saw was like a leopard, and its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. And one of its heads appeared to be fatally wounded, but its fatal wound was healed. The whole earth was amazed and followed the beast. They worshiped the dragon because he gave authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? Who is able to wage war against it?" The beast was given a mouth to utter boasts and blasphemies, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It began to speak blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his dwelling and those who dwell in heaven. And it was permitted to wage war against the saints and to conquer them. And it was also given authority over every tribe, every people, every language, and every nation. All those who live on the earth will worship it, everyone whose name is not written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb who is slaughtered. If anyone has ears to hear, let him listen. If anyone's to be taken captive, into captivity he goes. If anyone is to be killed with a sword he will be killed. This calls for endurance and faithfulness from the saints. And then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and it had 2 horns like a lamb, but it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast on its behalf and compels the earth and those who live on it to worship the first beast whose fatal wound was healed. It also performs great signs, even causing fire to come down from heaven to earth in front of the people. It deceives those who live on the earth because of the signs that it is permitted to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who live on the earth to make an image of the beast who was wounded by the sword and yet lived. It was permitted to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast could both speak and cause whoever would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And it makes everyone, small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on his right hand or on his forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. The beast's name or number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, because it is the number of a person. Its number is 666. Then I looked, and there was the Lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him were the 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads. And I heard a sound from heaven, like the sound of cascading waters and like the rumbling of loud thunder. The sound I heard was like harpists playing on their harps. They sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, but no one could learn the song except for the 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. These are the ones who have not defiled themselves with women since they remained virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. They were redeemed from humanity as the first fruits for God and the Lamb. No lie was found in their mouths. They are blameless. Then I saw another angel flying high overhead with the eternal gospel to announce to all the inhabitants of the earth, to every nation, to every tribe, to every language and people. And he spoke with a loud voice, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship the one who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of water." And another angel followed, saying, "It has fallen. Babylon the Great has fallen. She has made all the nations drink the wine of her sexual immorality, which brings wrath." And another a third angel followed them and spoke with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he will also drink the wine of God's wrath, which is poured full strength into the cup of his anger. He will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the sight of the holy angels and the sight of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment will go up forever and ever. There is no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and its image, or anyone who receives the mark of its name. This calls for endurance from the saints who keep God's command and their faith in Jesus. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, so they will rest from their labors since their works follow them. And then I looked, and there was a white cloud, and one like a son of man who was seated on the cloud with a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, crying out in a loud voice to the one who was seated on the cloud, use your sickle and reap, for the time to reap has come, since the harvest of the earth is ripe. So the one seated on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was harvested. And then another angel, who also had a sharp sickle, came up out of the temple in heaven. And yet another angel, who had authority over fire, came from the altar, and he called out with a loud voice to the one who has the sharp sickle, use your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of grapes from the vineyard of the earth, because its grapes have been ripened. And so the angel swung his sickle at the earth and gathered the grapes from the vineyard of the earth, and he threw them into the great winepress of God's wrath. And then the press was trampled outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press up to the horses' bridles for about 180 miles. May God bless this reading of his word. You may be seated. There is so much there in that passage, some of which is famous, or maybe we should say infamous, a lot of which you may look at and you may say, I have no idea what the heck is going on. And while we are not going to have time to cover all the details of this exhaustively, which for some of you might be a relief, I think we can boil the main point of these two chapters down to one verse. Or really, it comes up in two verses, but we're going to use one verse. Revelation 13, verse 10 says, this calls for endurance and faithfulness from the saints. This calls for endurance and faithfulness from the saints. And really, I would argue that is the main point of this passage. We are to read this passage in light of everything else that we've read in Revelation about the work of Christ for us and the great spiritual war we're in and the greatness of God, and we are to learn how to endure. And this passage, Revelation chapters 13 and 14, you could tag chapter 12 in as well, are trying to help us get a hint at some of the things we will have to endure in this world as Christians. And what I'm going to argue tonight is that actually these two chapters, Revelation chapter 13 and chapter 14, are looking at the same thing from two different angles. Chapter 13 is looking at this from the earthly angle. Chapter 14 is looking at this from the heavenly angle. But we're talking about the same thing, about the saints enduring attacks of Satan in this world. And that's, if we were to summarize the whole thing, that's what we're getting at. Inside of all the weirdness, I think the point is clear. But what I want us to do is I want to break down in a little more detail some of the major elements of these two chapters, similar like we did last week, and then I want to do a lot of application in light of that. So we're going to do some breakdown with a couple questions along the way, and then close with some bigger picture application for how do we persevere in this world as Christians. So one of the first things I think we can notice if we were to look at chapter 13, which is Earth's perspective, is that we see three major evil forces. We see three major evil forces. We see Satan, we see a beast that comes from the sea, and we see a beast that comes from the land. And these three major evil forces form something like an unholy version of the Trinity. They form something like an unholy version of the Trinity. And they are meant to parody God and all of his goodness in this world. Satan loves to parody God's good gifts in this world. He loves to parody things. Like we'll see in just a little bit, even the land beast itself, you'll notice it says it has two horns like a lamb but speaks like a dragon. It's a parody of Jesus. Satan is parodying Jesus. Some would even argue that Satan has never had an original idea. All he can do is warp and twist and rip off the good ideas of God, and he turns them for evil. One of the most compelling things in all of the book called The Screwtape Letters, which if you've never read it, it is phenomenal. Screwtape Letters is so good. And The Screwtape Letters, written by C.S. Lewis, is meant to be kind of this discovered set of letters of a senior demon writing to a junior demon. And the senior demon is trying to explain to this junior demon how to tempt humanity and how to turn people away from God. And it's as if we've just discovered the enemy's mail and we're trying to learn their tactics. And one of C.S. Lewis's most insightful lines in that book is when he has the senior demon writing to the junior demon, and he says, when we tempt people with things, when we as demons put pleasures before people to tempt them to sin, we need to be careful. Because at some level, when we involve ourselves in joy and pleasure, we try to tap into that deep sense in humanity's brain, we are on the enemy's ground. And the reason he says is because we, demons, did not create pleasure. God created pleasure. Now, for some of you, that may be a shock. For some of you, you grew up viewing Christianity as just a list of a bunch of different rules. It was a big killjoy. And you watched all your friends doing what seemed like the fun things, and you felt like Christianity was no fun. And if that's what you grew up with, I just have way better news for you. God himself is the source of all of our joy. And the way to have the most joy and pleasure in this world is by using God's good gifts in the way he intended them. By using God's good gifts in the way he intended them. So every time we are tempted with some pleasure, something we know is sinful, we know is not right, we can remember that it is not near as good as the good thing God is offering us. Does that make sense? So we need to keep that in mind. Satan, all of the time, will take some of God's good gifts and he will parody them. He will twist them and he will offer them to us. So take, for example, the gift of sex. God gave sex to humanity as a good and right thing in the context of marriage between a man and a woman. And yet what Satan does is he takes that good gift and he offers it to us in ways that God never intended. So while sex in the context of marriage between a man and a woman is meant to bring intimacy and relationship and emotional fulfillment and even physical life, when it happens outside of the context of marriage, in the context of sin, we see it often brings emotional damage, destroys relationships, and often through abortion ends in death. See, Satan is twisting the good things that God has given us. And so I want to pause for a moment as we consider how to be aware of Satan's tactics. Satan likes to parody God, and he likes to use God's good gifts and good tactics for evil. What are some other ways in which Satan twists God's good way and God's good gifts? What are some other ways? We won't go to tables on this, but raise your hand. Shout out your answer. What are some ways in which Satan twists God's good gifts? What are some other examples of this? The easy answer is just think of any sin and then think about how it might be twisted from a good thing. So again, we could think of different things even still, but it's worth us reminding ourselves of the principle that Satan parodies God's good truth. So whether it's this unholy trinity of the beast and the dragon, whether the way Satan tempts us into sin, the way that Satan uses authority in the world, like we're going to see, Satan parodies God's good truth. Now let's just look at the beasts for just a moment, just so we have an idea of what's going on. We don't have a lot of time to go into detail, but I'm just going to give you a few tidbits so you have a sense of what is happening here. For the sea beast, this imagery of the various animals, that is pulled straight out of Daniel chapter 7. That is straight out of Daniel chapter 7. This is a clear Old Testament allusion. And in Daniel 7 and leading into this passage, we have the lion, which represents Babylon. This represents different nations. You have the bear, represents Persia or Medo-Persia. You have this four-headed leopard, which represents the Greek Empire, which splits into four after Alexander the Great, for you history nerds out there. And you've got this fourth beast, which represents Rome. Now, you don't need to remember all of those different things. If you're listening to that and you're like, I'm not going to remember any of that. What does that have to do with this? Let me kind of summarize the illusion that's happening here. This sea beast, in part, is meant to represent, particularly when it represents Rome, is representing what happens in the world when great government authority is mixed with religious fervor and fusion. And what happens when the governments of the world, or earthly powers of this planet, oppose God and his way. So these beasts, in part, particularly the sea beast, as it represents Rome, think about Rome, this great empire, this powerful empire, most powerful empire in the world, and yet, if you think about what Rome does, it persecutes Christians, it opposes God. Its Emperor Nero, if you've heard of him, so opposes Christians that he tries to root out the whole religion, even persecuting them to the point where he would impale Christians on a stake, cover them in hot tar, and light them on fire to light his garden at night. And he would listen to the screams of their suffering as if it was a song and a lullaby to his ears. I mean, that's the kind of persecution we're talking about. It's when governments and earthly powers get too big for their britches, they try to take the role of God, and they oppose God and his people. That's what this is beginning to represent. And we even see extra hints of this because of this reference, of this idea that this beast has a head that has a fatal wound, and yet he somehow lived. And this is a multifold kind of illusion. First, a lot of scholars believe this is an allusion to Nero himself, a Roman emperor who persecuted Christians. And Nero, if you know anything about his story, Nero commits suicide. But a lot of folks at the time thought he had just gone into hiding. And so there's this thought that he was going to come back or resurrect. And so it would seem like he had a fatal wound and yet he was going to come back to life. So we think this is a reference to Nero. But it's also a reference to the idea of how in world history, if you just trace out world history, you will find that when one great empire dies, another one immediately seems to rise up. Doesn't matter if there's a fatal wound. Supposedly, you know, the Roman Empire died. Whenever you think that happened, whether it's in the Ottomans later or early on in the 400s, being attacked by the Goths, one empire dies, another empire rises up and ends up getting far too big for its own britches. It opposes God and his people and tries to take God's place on the throne. So this is some of what the beasts are trying to represent here. Some of what the beasts are trying to represent. Rome represents the incredible nature of earthly power mixed with religious power waged against God and his people. And we have seen this in history. We have seen this many times over. We see it in the Gospels and in Acts with the Jews and the Romans pairing up. We see this later on in history in different ways with jihadist Islam. We see it with Christian nationalism. And I would argue in some ways that we even see it in progressive movements, which form a kind of worldview or almost a religious place in life for many folks and the way it's paired with government authority. So we see this kind of thing all of the time. And so here's where I want to pause for a moment at our table. And I want to ask for respectful discussion in this, but I think this discussion is important so we can be aware. What are some ways in which, in the course of our day, at this moment, we see governmental authority fuse with religious fervor? Governmental authority fuse with religious fervor. And again, just nuance this. This doesn't have to be a traditional religion. Again, I would argue that a lot of worldviews today, particularly secular worldviews, can actually represent a kind of religion for people. They have creeds where there's certain things that people have to believe, otherwise they're out of the movement. There are worship services, which are the equivalent of great protests or gatherings. There are pastors or priests and the great leaders of the movement. There's even evangelism in the way people will share this message all around. I mean, these form a religious significance for people. So these don't have to be just traditional religions. What are some ways in which we see government given both great authority and religious fervor in our day? Talk about this at your tables for 2 or 3 minutes, and then we'll get some answers. Yes. So just a little clarity. What are ways in which you look out at our world today, particularly even in our culture, and you see the way in which government has great authority, but also it acts as if it has kind of religious function? So let me give you an example. I'm trying not to get too controversial with this one. There is a sense in which if you want to be trained to be a doctor, you essentially have to agree to either bless or perform trans-affirming care, abortions, or euthanasia. And government-approved boards are supporting this. And that is an abuse of government authority in a way that it's causing people to bow down. You could even just look at the ways in which people have given government almost religious significance. They've put their trust in government over God. And this is not a Republican thing or a Democrat thing. This is just an American thing, a world thing. But what are ways in which, let me reframe it, make it a little easier. What are ways in which you see people putting their trust in government over God? And it's a hint for you of the way in which they're trusting a governmental authority over God's authority. So talk about that at your tables for a couple minutes, and then we'll get some answers. Okay, for the sake of time, we're going to continue on. But as you think about the discussion, one of the reasons I want us to talk about this is not to cause debate. I know these are sensitive matters, but it's because we have to have some kind of awareness of, again, think back to the way in which Satan parodies God's good gifts. Government is not a bad thing. If you read Romans 13, if you look at the way God has given government in the world and humans' dominion over the world, government in itself is not a bad thing. It's a good thing, actually. It's meant to bring order to the world and justice to the world. And yet, when it is given too much authority and treated like it is God and that it is the thing that will satisfy us and ultimately protect us more than God, there's an issue. There's an idol at play. And Satan loves to play on those dynamics. Satan loves to play on those dynamics. And we just have to be aware of that. Again, the government's a good thing, but the government is not God. God is our ultimate protector. He's the one that ultimately gives us life and helps us flourish. And so we use the good gifts he's given us in government. We don't put government in the place of God. And over history, there have been many nations and empires that have done that. And we need to be aware of it. If we were to continue to look at just the other figures, again, we see the land beast, who also has great authority, and he's parroting Jesus. He's got two horns like a lamb, but he speaks like Satan. And again, it's parroting Jesus. Satan is taking a good thing of Jesus, and he's twisting it. And yet it's in this land beast that we see the very infamous mark of the beast. And I'm just going to go ahead and do a spoiler alert. The mark of the beast is not a barcode. So if you grew up believing it was a barcode or a tattoo suddenly, and you're like, oh my gosh, like, what's going on? That's not what's happening here. Let me just spoil that now. The mark of the beast has symbolic significance. And this is really important. And I just want to, if you grew up in an evangelical background, especially you're a 90s kid, early 2000s kid, I want you to hear me say this. This is symbolic significance. If you want to pinpoint one thing in history that was the mark of the beast, I think you're missing the point of this passage. If you think about the way we've read Revelation up to this point, Revelation shows us that there's lots of symbolism here at play. I mean, think about it, even just the idea of a fatal wound that's healed. That doesn't make any sense. How can you have a fatal wound that heals? You're either dead or you're alive. I mean, it's like, how does that work? No one but Christ here is truly coming back to life. So how does that make sense? It's meant to be symbolism. There's lots of things in Revelation here. It's meant to be symbolism. So if we think in symbolic terms, what might the passage be getting at in terms of the mark of the beast? I think it's another parody. I think it's another parody of God. Satan is parodying a good thing of God. If you know your Old Testament very well, you will know that this is a parody of the Torah. Because in the Torah, God's people are known by a mark over their doors or by a mark of the Torah on their forehead. Some of them would literally wear like a little mark of the Torah on their forehead, like a little roll of papyrus on their forehead. As a way to say, God's law is ever before me. It was a mark meant to mark them out as God's faithful people, that they trusted in his word. And now, the beast is signifying people by a mark. This is a parody of God's good word in the Old Testament. This is a parody. And so it's a way of identifying people and movements that are opposed to God and are twisting God's good things. And so I don't think there's one specific historical thing, like one day there'll be this one mark that you get, it's a credit card, you know, or some of the Left Behind folks have said. It's nothing like that. Rather, we need to be vigilant about the way in which we are faithful to what God commands. As Christians, we are called to be faithful to what God commands. Are we going to be complicit in what the world is doing to oppose God and his forces? And we'll explain a little more of that in a second. But let's get to the number, 666. Let's get to the number. 666 is an example in the ancient world of what is called gematria. Gematria, or some people say gematria, depends how you want to pronounce it. This is just a fancy way of saying that in a lot of ancient languages, Hebrew and Latin and Greek and others, you could pair a letter of the language with a number of the language. And so the letters would equal numbers. Like, for example, the letter A could equal the number 1. And over the course of someone's name, well, these letters would add up to be a number. And so you could throw out a number that would represent a name. Does that make sense? You know, you could add up those letters together. We don't really have something like this in English. The closest we get is when people on their license plates, you know, they try to spell out a word, but they mix in numbers that look like letters. It's not even quite the same thing. But in the ancient world, you could pair a letter with a number. And so you could, as a joke or parody, you could say a number and people might have a word or a name in mind. One of the most famous instances of this in archaeology is that in ancient Rome, we have this example of the graffiti where someone has said, "I love the one whose number is like 765 or something like that. And they're alluding to a name. They're trying to be secretive about the name of the person, basically. It's just a clever thing. It's a game you could play. So in light of that, 666 is an example of this in the ancient world. If in Hebrew you were to spell out Nironius Caesar, think of Nero because he's a leader, he's Caesar. Nironius Caesar adds up to 666. Now, here's where I think it gets extra convincing. Some of you in your Bible will have a footnote on that verse, and I'm watching everybody like looking at the footnote, where they will say, some manuscripts say 616. And the reason that's there is to say that some scribe would have said, you know what, no, people are calling him Nero Caesar, not Neronius Caesar. And so they would change it to 616 because the Nero Caesar adds up to 616. And so it's just, to me, it's this extra evidence of saying, no, we're talking about Nero here. This is what 666 stands for. Now, it's not trying to signify Nero himself alone. It's trying to say, what does Nero signify? Nero is an example of a leader and represents even the nation of Rome who tried to seek out too much power and authority and oppose God's people. And this is what the 666, this mark of the beast, is representing. But there's more significance here. Six is the number of man. Mankind was created in the sixth day in Genesis. And if you think about it, the number of perfection is 7. So 777 is this perfect and holy number. 6 is incomplete. It's like it's a parody of the complete number, but it's not quite there. It's fallen, it's broken, it's twisted. So all of this is going on in this number 666, this representation of the idea of what happens when a person or an empire or a movement seeks out far too much authority and opposes God. That is a sense of what's happening. Does that make sense? So it's not some harebrained theory. This is just meant to be clear symbolism that we have seen all the way back in Revelation. One final note that I will just say about the number before we talk through a couple questions here. You can't accidentally get the mark of the beast. There are some Christian traditions that would say you can accidentally get it. You're not going to wake up one day and be like, oh my gosh, I have the mark. What do I do? It doesn't work that way. The concept they're getting at, you think about if this mark was required to purchase and to have goods and participate in society, is it's hinting at this idea that society will pressure Christians to conform to unholy ways in order to participate in the world. Does that make sense? Society will pressure us in unholy ways to participate in its unholy things in order to be part of society. And so as Christians, one of the things we have to do is we have to say, how might we be complicit in unholy things in our world? How might we be complicit in unholy things in our world? And we need to be aware of the ways in which that is true, because as Christians, we need to stand for truth and holiness and God's way. And if all we're ever doing is caving under pressure, just so we can kind of continue on with life in a comfortable way, we need to know that that will not work out well in the end. If you are someone that feels the great pressure of the world around you, and you think, if I cave this one time, it'll lighten the pressure, it's not true. The pressure just keeps on getting harder. You either persevere as a Christian and you face pressure, or you collapse and crumble and you still face pressure. Either way, we will face pressure as Christians in this world. There's no such thing as an easy Christian life. All of us in different ways will be pressured to comply with unholy ways of the world. And we have to figure out, how are we going to be holy in this life? I mean, one of the simple examples would be in high school. Maybe some of you were pressured to drink underage and do things and take drugs and substances that you know are not right. You know you're not supposed to disobey your parents and do things that are not right. You felt that pressure. We all felt that peer pressure. As a Christian, are you going to stand up to that? Because if you think about it, in the culture of your high school, if you went to public school, you probably felt this sense in which, what is this going to do to my friendships? Will I be able to participate in the culture of my school? I won't be a popular kid anymore. I won't have a say in different things if I don't cave into this pressure. Am I going to be complicit in this? Or am I going to stand tall and obey the Lord? There's examples like that everywhere in the real world, in your office, in your college, maybe even in your family. How are we going to stand for truth and persevere as Christians? This calls for faithfulness and endurance. So here's the question I want to put forward to you at your tables to talk about. What are ways in which we are subtly pressured to deny God's good way? What are subtle ways in our world that we are pressured to deny God's good way? We are asked to be complicit in the unholiness of the world. What are some ways in which we are pressured by our world? Talk about that at your table for a few minutes. We'll get some answers, and then we will move to chapter 14. So Lena says youth sports. I'm going to stop on this one because I'm just going to make a little note. Just as people that many of us will one day have kids and families, do you want to know the two biggest reasons? This is sociological data. This is not an opinion. This is just fact. You want to know the two biggest reasons why people did not return to church consistently after COVID? Number one is because they got out of the habit. And that makes sense. You know, it's nice having some free time on a Sunday morning. I get it. I mean, even as a staff member, I felt that. I'm like, woo, I can sleep in. Feels good. I get that. You get out of the habit. Or they move. The other reason is youth sports. And to Lena's point, our culture has done it so much so that even if you miss a few games, you're kicked off the team if there's a game on a Sunday. We have staff members that have had that happen to them with their kids, where there's been pressure to do it. I mean, it's a serious thing. Are we going to comply? There are things like that everywhere that might seem mundane, but they have a huge spiritual effect. The main reasons people are leaving the church are not deconstruction or a political idolatry or something like that, although those are there. Youth sports and moving and out of the habit of because of COVID. Things we would take as mundane but are incredibly serious, subtle ways in which we are pressured to comply with unholy worldviews. That's a great answer. Let me close this out in this way. Chapter 14 can be summarized much more simply than chapter 13. In chapter 14, it can be broken down into three parts. Part number one is the worship of heaven. The worship of heaven. Now, you'll see that reference to harps. And maybe some of you, if you're honest, your view of heaven, which we'll talk about more in a future week, but your view of heaven is much more like clouds are everywhere and there's some pearly golden gates off in a corner and St. Peter's probably over there and there's some beautiful looking angel with a kind of a toga on just, basically playing the harp really softly. That is not what is happening here. So if you thought heaven was about to be the most boring place in the world, I can just assure you it will not. Just take a second and look with me at the first few verses of chapter 14. You've got the 144,000 there, which if you've been here in past weeks, you'll know that's just representing all of God's redeemed people. So there's not only 144,000, it's a symbolic way of saying it's many, many, many people of God. And it says this, I heard a sound from heaven like the sound of cascading waters and like the rumbling of loud thunder. And it is like heaven is erupting, like the whole roof is about to blow off the building because people are so ecstatic in praise to God. They are so excited to sing praise. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain, because our God has won the victory. I mean, it's the equivalent of a last, I mean, if you guys remember that Bills game when the Chiefs won, there's 13 seconds down, and the way people freaked out when the Chiefs came away with the victory and Travis Kelce catches the pass late in the game. That kind of eruption, I mean, is nothing to what we will experience in heaven, because the excitement about who God is and his victory will be so great. That's what we're talking about. There will be excitement in heaven. So in the midst of the worship of heaven, we also get this view of the harvest of the earth. And we see the wheat harvest, depending on your translation, or the harvest of the earth. And we see the harvest of the grapes. And those are getting at similar things. You've got the Son of Man, which is representing Jesus. And this comes from, again, from Daniel 7. Later on, after the beasts show up, you see the Son of Man meeting up with the Ancient of Days. And we see Jesus pulling out God's elect from the world. This is not a rapture. We're not even going to touch that tonight. That's for a future week. This is not a rapture, but this is to say that God's people are secure and they will be in glory with God. And so God's people are secure. And then what happens next? You have the pulling into the grapes. And these grapes and the wine that is poured out represent God's wrath for the ways in which our unholy world has pressured and killed Christians. And you'll see this imagery of a cup in Scripture. Jesus even uses it in the garden, where he says, "Lord, if it be your will, let this cup pass from me." The cup represents God's wrath, his justice poured out onto sin and the world. And so what's happening here is the blood of the saints is, in a sense, representing this idea of the wrath of God poured out, because one day in judgment, God will say, "World that has stood against me, look what you have done to my people, and I'm going to bring perfect and supreme justice once and for all." And God's wrath is poured out in judgment over the world. So much so that, just to get at the symbolism of the passage, says, "The press was trampled outside the city, and blood flowed out of the press up to the horses' bridles for about 180 miles. Imagine, blood up to here for 180 miles. And it's just representing that our world is so opposed to God that God will bring justice once and for all. And that's a good thing for us. If you're a Christian here tonight, and you can think of all of the ways in which you feel pressured by the world, hurt by the world, hurt by satanic forces, all things opposed to God that have beat you up as a believer, have abused you, you can know that our God sees that. He knows it. And one day he will bring absolute, perfect justice to everything, better than any kind of vengeance you and I could ever bring. And it will be incredible. And it will be a picture for God, or for the world, of God's great love and goodness to us, his people. So, as we think about chapter 14, we can know that we can endure, because we know that God will not give up on his people. We are secure with him, and God will bring perfect justice to our world, and we will be with God forever. Doesn't matter the pressure we feel. Even if we were to die for our faith, we can know that we have hope. That's what this whole book is about, is having hope in God in hard times. Revelation doesn't have to be complicated. We can get so in the details we miss the point. We're meant to have hope in God because of Jesus. Because of Jesus, we will not face the second death. Because of Jesus, we can stand before the judgment of God. Because of Jesus, we will have joy with God forever. And so when you're at the office and you feel the pressure to be complicit or to comply with unholy things, you can know that I can stand as a Christian. I can withstand. It is worth it to persevere. When you are in your family and you are pressured to do things you know are not right, you can withstand the pressure to be a witness for God and know that it is worth it. And on and on and on. No matter what happens, we can know that our perseverance will be worth it. And just as Paul says in Romans 8:18, that the suffering now is nothing compared to the glory that we will experience. And I just want to say in closing that I'm so proud. I know the stories of a number of you. I know some of the ways that you have been pressured, and some of them may seem insignificant, but They're important. And the ways that you have withstood the pressure, you've said, no, I'm not going to give in. And I am so proud of you. That is a big deal. And even if it's the littlest, tiniest thing, it's got to start somewhere. Your victory with God has to start somewhere. And so I'm proud of you for the way you have stood up. Continue to do it. It's not an easy thing, but guys, it is so incredibly worth it. May we have hope in Jesus. May we withstand the pressures of this world, because it will be worth it. And one day we will get to sing together about the great joy that we have in Jesus. Let's pray. God, I thank you for the hope that we have in Jesus. I thank you that we can withstand the pressures of this world. God, would you help us by your Holy Spirit to withstand? Would you allow us to keep your word on our head, in our hearts, that we would be marked by the blood of Jesus and your word, not by the marks of a world that is opposed to you, God? Would you give us the confidence, the wherewithal, the endurance to make it through the pressures that we feel in this world? And God, I just want to pray right now for my friends in the room, whatever ways in which they feel that pressure, God, would you give them strength? Would you bless them for the ways that they have tried to stay true to your name? And in those tough moments, God, would you give them a sense of the glory and the joy that we will have with you forever, to inspire them to continue? And they will remember that the accusations of Satan have no authority on them. The shame of Satan has no authority on them. The threats of this world have no authority on them. The temptations of Satan have no authority over them, because God, you offer us something infinitely better that can never be taken away. And we put our hope in that, namely Jesus. So we pray all of this in his mighty name. Amen.